As you look at the slide before you, what you see is a kind of an unusual picture, as a matter of fact. How many of you recognize what this structure is right here? You know what that is? Anybody? Okay, that is Masada. What's unusual is that all the tour groups come up on a cable car system that's on the back side. You get into this area right here where you land, you don't come out and you stay on top. You don't very often find that people make the effort, because it is difficult, to get off to the west so that they can take a picture looking to the east like this. This is the remnants, or are the remnants, of the 2,000-year-old now ramp that the Romans built to the sail in. So they filled the entire valley here, and then were able finally to work their way to the top, where they found that 900 Jews had committed suicide. In the valley, of course, below there is the Dead Sea, which has receded very greatly, so that it used to be a solid water, probably all the way up to this level right here. Now you can see that you've got all these land bridges and stuff that has appeared. It's been drying out for decades now. But as you can see from the notation at the bottom, we're going to have occasion to think about the temptations of Jesus tonight and several other temptations, as we do the second in our series on temptation and sin and then forgiveness. Last week we talked about temptation, we're doing it again today. This is just the general region. The wilderness of Judea is vast. It's just vast. That's Jordan, the country of Jordan. It's the hills that are on the other side. So you've had a number of Gentile nations that have lived over in that region. But on the western shores of the Dead Sea, and even running the whole length of the Dead Sea and up to the north of its northern shores, you know, it's all the wilderness of Judea. And it is just unbelievably empty. It's just rocks and sand. Jesus spent 40 days out there, didn't eat for 40 days while he was out there, and then became hungry. We'll have more to say about that in just a minute, but there is some idea, at least, of what that region looks like. Sin is the overall topic that we're dealing with. We're dealing with first the temptation that leads to it, and then afterwards the forgiveness that's necessary because of it. So we started last week with just a simple and basic problem stated in Isaiah 59, a host of other places, that iniquities have made separation between you and your God, and your sins have hidden his face from you. This is the problem, and it has always been the problem. Now, last week, we talked particularly about the word temptation. We talked about how it sometimes appropriately is translated testing. And so for just a minute, I'd like to summarize that by dealing with a thought that we didn't talk about at all last week. But like for everybody, try to picture, however you do in your mind, quite the opposite of the wilderness of Judea. What was Eden like? What was the Garden of Eden like? That must have been something. Now, John and I lived up in Washington most of our lives, of course. If you've ever been to the Bouchard Gardens that are across the border up there in Canada, many of you have. Good for you. That's impressive. But what was it next to the Garden of Eden? Well, it had to be just pathetic, you know. So I've been to Banff, and I've been to the Grand Canyon, and I've been to bunches of places. I've been to the Philippines. They've got some scenery there that is just truly just astonishingly beautiful. Can any of it compare with the Garden of Eden? I guess not. The Garden of Eden is paradise on earth. And what was the Garden of Eden, brethren? It's the place where God put Adam and Eve for what? Testing. This is where they were tested. Adam and Eve were created in the flesh, apparently, with eternal life, so that they could have lived forever in that garden. But they were being tested. Not tempted. God didn't want them to fail. He didn't want to take them out of the garden. He didn't want them to experience cold or hunger. He didn't want them to know what it was to have to work by the sweat of your brow, you know, and there'd be briars and brambles. None of that was what God wanted. He put them in the Garden of Eden. But it was the place of testing. Will you obey me? Will you keep my law? My law is to tend the garden and not eat from that tree right over there. Every time I think about the temptation of that tree, I'm reminded of an old Creedence Clearwater revival song. Take you a glass of water and make it against the law. See how good the water tastes when you can't have any at all. Okay. It was just a reference to fundamental human nature. Tell somebody they can't have something and then what? All your attention just focuses on that. It's just the way we work. Long ago, and James Dobson, you know, was so famous for Focus on Family and all that. He had participated as a psychologist, I guess, in some testing in which they took a bunch of preschool children and they would put them into a room and they would say to them, you know, now you can play with anything in this room. There's just one thing you can't do. You can't take any candy from that bowl that's on the table. Now they were doing it to tell the difference between boys and girls. And the difference between boys and girls was profound. The difference was that the boys immediately went to the table. And they were just fixated. The girls could play with all those toys. And they had that place outfitted with every toy you could imagine. And the girls could play with the toys. But you know what the big difference was between the boys and the girls? Nothing at all. It just took the girls longer to get into the candy. But they all did. So they can stave it off longer. But eventually you tell somebody, you have paradise to play with in this room. But there's one thing you can't do. And somehow we are drawn to it. There is an allure. There is a call. There is a temptation. God does not want us to fail. The testing of the psychologist is not because they want you to fail. But ultimately, when you sin, when you fail, with regard to God's rules, then a separation exists. It comes between you and God, and He hides His face. He is pure. He is light, and in Him there is no darkness. He must turn away. And we know about redemption. We had a very long series on the scheme of redemption. We see how intricately God developed it over millenniums to bring us back from this sin. But our purpose on Sunday nights is just to try to understand what gets us in trouble in the first place, how tremendously important it is that we stay out of trouble even now after we have been bought back by the sacrifice of Jesus the Christ. So, okay, sin makes a separation. This comes to us because of the appeal of temptation. So, fine, you know, what is it? Now, pardon me for being, you know, a grandpa. But recently, I had to take my grandkids, you see all three of them there, you know, to a reptile farm thing that's up not far from where they live, up in Washington. What you see in the back there is a very good friend of the family. You'll see another picture of her. That's Christina Wadley, kind of the daughter that we never had. And so she had gone with us that day. She's known kids for a long time, been a friend of the family. But you see the expression on those kids' faces. And there's kind of several expressions, too. Sophie's the oldest there on the left. And she's always the one that's looking for advice and instruction and wants to do things exactly right. And then the youngest is the boy. What's he got on his face? You know. And at that moment, in between, there's Kate, you know, and she's just focused on that snake. But okay, immediately, they see this thing. And immediately, what happens? All your attention focuses on it. Now, brethren, is ignorance about anything bliss? Well, no. Ignorance is always a problem. So, had that been a rattlesnake, had that been a viper, had that been a number of other snakes, you suppose little Kate would be leaning in like that? Yeah, probably. She's an ignorant kid. Kids get bit by rattlesnakes all the time. Because what? They don't know any better. They're not aware of the dangers. They haven't been taught and then thought about and internalized it sufficiently to know I shouldn't get that close to a rattlesnake. This is not a rattlesnake, obviously. Excuse me. But you see the allure and the attraction. That attraction needs education. What has to be taught is what is safe and what isn't. In this case, we're all trusting the snake handler. Okay, I did. We all did. We took it for granted they knew what they were doing. And so I just had more fun in that moment, positioned myself, you know, and everything, and watched what was happening there. Those kids just live in pure delight. Okay? But brethren, here's our problem with every decision and everything that appears before us in life. There's little Kate again. Some things are absolutely, perfectly safe. And others, like this black mamba, as opposed to that garden snake that's everywhere in America, this is one of the deadliest snakes on earth. I looked at several lists. People fight about which one's the worst. Some talk about how much toxin there is. Others talk about how many actually get bites, or bitten and get bites. But the most, you know, the most dangerous snake, as far as toxins go, hardly ever kills anybody because it's very reclusive, you know, stays away. But that the mambas are extremely aggressive. They'll chase you, and they're fast. They'll come after you like a dog would. They'll chase you. Stories Roald Dahl will tell if you ever read about him, you know, wrote the children's books that had some adventures with those kinds of things. Our problem, brethren, is that when we come into this earth, we don't know the difference. And unless we are properly taught, unless, like you are all doing tonight, you invest that time and that effort, set aside all these other considerations to be here and find out what is right, what is wrong, what is healthy, what is fatal, then we're going to have serious problems. We're going to make mistakes and get tangled up with the wrong snakes in life. So let's start our discussion this evening with Ron's reading from 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 through 17. You already heard it read. I'm going to put it back up on the screen for you. Do not love the world. Do not love the world, nor the things in the world. That's a command. It's like, don't eat from that tree. And all of the Edenic paradise is the consequence. Keep it or lose it. But don't love the world, nor the things in the world. It's one of the most fundamentally basic commands that God has ever given. And then it follows, if anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. Now, brother, these seem to be mutually exclusive terms. The way God presents this to us is there isn't any third option. There is no middle ground. If anyone loves the world, do I love the world? Do you love the world? Do we love the world? Well, if you do, then the love of the Father is not in you. You can't serve God and mammon, is the way Jesus put it somewhere else. One wins, the other loses, and that's the way it is. You're not going to set some kind of new record or standard and figure a third way. There aren't any. For all, he continues in 1 John 2, that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life is the New American Standard translation. There are wide variances in the translations because the single word that's translated boastful pride in the New American is just one Greek word. It really is kind of tough to translate into English. I've numbered them because these are the three things that are all that is in the world. And if you love the world, love the Father is not in you. Don't do that. It is forbidden. Lose everything you do. Here's what you could love. And if you do, the love of the Father is not in you, you're lost. There's the lust of the flesh, there's the lust of the eyes, and there is the boastful pride of life. This is how most of the temptations in life are characterized. And then it continues, is not, these three things, is not from the Father, but is from the world. The world is passing away, and its lusts. It is passing away. These physical laws tell us that matter is decaying, and it will continue to do so till it is no more. And so the world's passing away, and the hungers, the desires, the attractions, the allures, and the appeals that we find in this life, that is, the lust that the flesh produces in us, the lust of the eyes, we'll define these in a moment, and this boastful pride of life, these things, brethren, they're in the world, they're from the world, they're not in the Father, and the world's passing away, and those lusts are going away too. But the one who does the will of God lives forever. Now, Adam and Eve could have lived forever and populated the earth with maybe 10 times more people than we have now, I suppose, and perhaps that garden would have spread across the surface of all the earth had nobody ever sinned. But the one who does the will of God lives forever. And Adam and Eve didn't. I haven't. You haven't. And nobody said Jesus has been entirely free from sin, I don't suppose. Oh, I'm sorry, got ahead of myself right there. So let me just say one more word about this pride of life thing. The lust of the flesh, we can get. There are certain demands that the physical body makes of us. And some of these are essential in order to survive, but we must never choose to survive at the cost of morality, at the expense of sin. And the lust of the eyes would be better defined, I think, as we go along in some of the charts I've got that are coming up. But this term, boastful pride of life, it's one Greek term. Some translate it, you know, like braggadocio. It has to do with being kind of puffed up and thinking highly of yourself, maybe speaking highly of yourself as well. Some translations just put pride, but there's this braggadocious sort of element that, you know, contained in the word. So you'll see different ways of translating it. But what it has to do with that kind of just swelling thought that I'm talented, that I know what I'm doing, that I'm in charge, I have succeeded. You know, hey, look at me, not because I'm the living example, as Paul was in our lesson this morning, of all that it is to be righteous and devoted, but look at me for my own sake. See what I've done. It's the attitude of Nebuchadnezzar on his walls, isn't it? Just before what? Just before his pride resulted in the fall. See all that I have done. Look at my wisdom, my money, my power. And he got to bragging about it. Even if it was just to himself at that moment, it didn't sound like anybody else was even there. But it's going to cost him everything. So here's our fundamental passage and our fundamental enemy. Because God put spirits within flesh, God knows what he's doing. The flesh has to survive in a physical world. And because it exists with physical senses, physical concerns, then these lusts, which are not evil in and of themselves, can result, though, in succumbing to sin. So was it wrong for Adam and Eve to see what they did about, you know, the forbidden fruit? It was only wrong for them to eat of it. So let's go back to them for just a second. The woman, it says in Genesis 3:6, saw that the tree was good for food. So, what was that that she was experiencing? The lust of the flesh. We get hungry. Their bodies got hungry. They were tilling the soil. They were producing crops. They were eating. They were drinking. They lived in the flesh exactly as we do. One fruit that was obviously good for food. Somehow, she sees this. She wants it for that purpose. Now, look at all the rest of the garden. It must have had 10,000 other fruits. You know, maybe extinct by now. But here's lots to eat. But that one was forbidden. That's the one that attracts attention then. Number two, it was a delight to the eyes. Now, nobody else would that fruit look like. Probably, though, the one thing we can be most certain of is that it was not a what? An apple. I don't want to pick the apple in the first place. You know, but we know it's probably that apple. It's not, it wasn't. The fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is not an apple. We don't have that tree. We don't have access to that tree anymore. We're still eating apples. Was not an apple. But I've seen a few apples that were worthy of a painter's talents. So have you. Still life, they call, you know, people just arrange the fruit and then they paint that. Sure enough, some people buy those things, maybe for a lot, hang them on the wall. Because the thing in itself can be pleasing to this particular organ, the eyes. And the delight to the eyes then attracts attention, which begins to involve the lust of the flesh. But the delight to the eyes is just something that is, let's say, pretty. It's attractive. And then third, it said that this fruit was desirable to make one wise. There was a desire to be wise, which wisdom, of course, we are taught to desire throughout all the scriptures. But this one is forbidden, and this allure is leading her to cross over the line. Now, it's very clear to me, and every commentator I've ever seen, you've probably heard this before, recognizes in Genesis account, there it is, lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, pride of life. She was subject to those three things that are in the world and failed the test. So, she ate. She convinced her husband somehow. We have no idea how. Don't know what his reasoning was. We are only told later, as Paul is informing Timothy, that Adam knew more about what he was doing than Eve did. In that, Eve was fooled by the serpent. She was deceived by the serpent. Somehow, he pulled the wool over her eyes. But not with Adam. And that is why this first sin is always charged to Adam, Romans chapter 5, for instance, rather than to Eve. Who ate first? Who failed first? Well, it was Eve. And then she gave to Adam. But she was fooled, and there is an ignorance, as Paul will also say, at least a measure of understanding, if not absolution, at least explanation, whereas Adam had no such thing. When Adam looked over there, he decided that he was going to fully consciously commit a sin. He did it. And it cost him. And it's cost everybody since then. And nobody's passed that test since then, whether you live in the Garden of Eden or not. You're all facing the same trials. What happened? She took from its fruit and she ate. Now there's another parallel, very plainly, in Luke chapter 4, verses 2 through 12. I'm not going to put it all up there, but we know Jesus was 40 days hungry. He became hungry. The tempter said, turn these stones to bread. To what is the tempter appealing? To the lust of the flesh. Is it a sin to want to eat? No, it's necessary to survive. Is it a sin to break a vow that you're not going to eat and then eat anyway? That's a sin. You've broken a vow. What I can understand about fasting is that it always has a beginning, middle, and an end, which is stipulated, you know, at the beginning. It appears to be you set a time, you explain to God what the need is, you define the terms, how your fast is going to work, however it is, and once you do, and you know, begin, you have a binding contract with your God. This must not be broken, these vows, this contract. So turn these stones to bread would have been a sin for Jesus. He would be violating some previous, you know, agreement that he had with God. But the lust of the flesh, Satan knows how to use. Number two, and I'm skipping so much of it, you know the story, but Satan said, I'll give you all the kingdoms of the world. But remember, somehow he was able to implant in Jesus' mind to present somehow before his eyes those kingdoms and, the scripture says, all of their glory. Remember that? All of their glory. To just be stunned by the greatest and the best and the wealthiest and most refined and beautiful that there was. Jesus apparently, in one magnificent moment, you know, saw it all. Satan thought that this sin would cause him to fall prey to that, the lust of the eyes. And then the last one is, throw yourself down, angels will come, lest you strike your foot against the stone. But it's pretty apparent, again, though not expressly stated, that the reason he took him to this point on the pinnacle of the temple, which I showed you last week, throw yourself down like this, is because it overlooked the whole city. It would be some kind of show. Everybody in town, they would look up and see that. What a magnificent moment. What a show. So, boastful pride. See what I can do. Now, brother, here's another shot of the wilderness of Judea. There are just endless miles of this wilderness of Judea. And you could get real hungry out there for 40 days. You could get awful hot. It gets well over 120 down there at the Dead Sea if he was close to that lowest point on earth. But even in the hills, you know, it's just hot over there. You've got a desire, a craving that after 40 days of hunger must be something to feel. Turn the stones into bread. Turn the stones to bread. You're the Son of God. Turn the stones to bread. And the flesh says yes. It's good for food. And the Spirit says no, because I have responsibilities before my God to die first before I would break my covenant, my vow. Jesus must not. Then we have the lust of the eyes. I don't know how many of you know this, because I didn't. Tell me if you know where this is. Okay? That is in Abu Dhabi, the White House. It's better than ours, isn't it? They're both white. But that is the presidential palace in Abu Dhabi. You got to go and Google this. It's a lot of fun. Just Google presidential palaces, and you will get not 1% of what Satan suddenly revealed all to Jesus. Somehow, all the kingdoms of the earth, all of their wealth and glory, that's just one guy's house right there in Abu Dhabi. All the world. Is it beautiful? Can you imagine what it looks like inside? Stroll those gardens, get out and do some fishing off the dock and on the backside there, whatever it is. And you look at it now. I don't think I've seen anybody turn away since I put it up. What happens to your eyes? I just got transfixed by it when I found the picture. And I just started kind of getting drawn in. You know, what are these things? And you can just see yourself going through cloisters and colonnades, and then it starts reminding me of how many times Solomon all over, you know, had built these columns and covered areas like that, you know, another hot climate and all the rest. And then your eyes look at this, and they look at this, and you begin to think, well, why can't I have things that are as nice as this? How come God doesn't, you know, let me live a little higher scale than I actually do? And the eyes are drawing you into sin. And then we have that pride of life. And there again is another shot. The southwest corner of the Temple Mount. Bear in mind, again, you're about, you know, 4.5 deeper to the ground level at the time of Jesus. It would have been very much higher, perhaps as much as 100 feet higher in Jesus' time, overlooking all of the hillside in which the city of Jerusalem sits upon. And the pride of life, that desire to have self-esteem. I did this. I take pride in what I've done. Whatever it is, the work of my hands, you know, something that I wrote, a play that I put on, you know, I mean, whatever it is in life. These temptations, brethren, cause us to hunger to cross God's lines. Just understand it. It was not wrong for Adam and Eve to look at that tree. It was not wrong for them to assess that tree. These lusts exist in the flesh because God put them there. They will help you to survive. You do need to eat, and that's why you have that appetite. It is all right for you to provide for your family, and that's why your eyes are always looking at the next upscale house that you hope to move into next. And it's okay, brethren, to want to be successful in life. The thing in itself is not wrong. Only when Satan uses it as a tool. Well, if I cheat just a little bit here, then I can have that thing that my flesh wants but knows it's forbidden and nobody will know. Or, you know, if I just do it this way, maybe it's not exactly really legal, but I get that house that I've been looking at for so long and that car, and I just really want it. And maybe I'll show off a little more, you know, and present myself as more than I really am. These things will kill you eternally. Not sin to feel the appeal. Sin when you cross over, as we saw from James chapter 1 last week. In John 8, verse 32, though, I would like to present, brethren, another form, probably,
of the pride of life part, I think. But there is one other temptation that is extremely prominent in Scripture. I'd like to set it forth before you really as a separate category, if you will, though I can see how it might fall into that last one. But in John 8:32, it says, "You shall know the what? Truth. And what will make you free?" See? Only the truth. Only the truth will set you free. No false doctrine will set you free. No lie will set you free. No exaggeration will set you free. Nothing except what is the stark reality of the truth. What Jesus was talking about there has to do with doctrinal truth. That is an understanding of the messages that God gives us recorded in His Word. When you depart from doctrinal truth, I mean, the principal reason people do that is because of the pride of life. They want to be known as Christians. They want the honor and the respect of being a refined individual who cares about morality and has risen above, you know, the mere animalistic tendencies of the world. But brother, it was Jesus' experience. It's been the experience of the Old Testament characters as well. It's our experience today. Who are among some of the most evil people that ever walked the earth? Religious dudes. That's who it is. These televangelists have set the record, you know, for the immorality that they practice. It's amazing. So if I can look at God's truth and then figure out ways to rationalize it, I just need to tweak it a little bit here. If we customize God's doctrine just a bit over here, you know, we need to emphasize this and de-emphasize that. You know, if I just customize that car that is the doctrinal truth, then, you know, God doesn't care and it's not a big deal. And the important thing is that we love Him. And so we will create new doctrine in our image rather than His. Now, this may be to satisfy some lusts of the flesh. It may be because of the lust of the eyes and wanting the bigger house and all the rest of that. We've certainly seen all these televangelists and so many others, you know, from the Pope on down, that are really into their money. You know, but just I'm just trying to hone in on the doctrine itself. If you were here this morning, you'll remember Galatians 1, verses 6 through 9. What do we find there? Though we or an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel other than, just different in any way, what we've already preached to you, let him be what? Accursed. God feels very strongly about this. And yet there are 2,000 different churches all claiming with their different doctrines to be going to heaven, to be pleasing God, to be serving Him, to be faithful in all of their departures from what the book actually says. So, brethren, I think primarily I put it in the pride of life. You can see how it fit into the other two. But I just want us to recognize temptation takes either physical or mental forms. It can be that I step over God's boundaries with something that I say or do, something that takes place in the flesh. But it can also be something that I do in my mind and it doesn't have to manifest itself in the flesh at all. And in that case, leaving the truth, which alone can set us free, is one of Satan's greatest temptations. Let me close with this thought. Brother, in the first century, it instantly assumed, as people began to embrace Jesus the Christ, what were the first things hit with? Persecution, resistance, opposition, suffering of every imaginable kind. And while the Galatians were departing, what was Paul doing with them? You had to push back from the truth as well. Satan's working it. But in the first century, if you wanted to be a Christian, did you have to count the cost very carefully? Because you could be in prison, you could lose your home, your children could be murdered, you could be killed on a cross. There's all this. And relatively, the doctrine stayed pretty pure. When did Satan really begin to win? There's a very famous early believer who said that the seed of the church
is the blood of the saints. So long as they were persecuted, and they knew what the cost of faithfulness was, then you hew the doctrinal line. You stick to the truth because you're willing to die for it. But along comes Constantine, and he changes everything, says it's now a state religion, there's not going to be any kind of persecution, and immediately we get the birth of Roman Catholicism, and changing everything. Now there's no price to pay at all. It appears to me, brethren, that in the early days, Satan just failed when he tried to apply force to stop the church. But then what worked? What worked was the subterfuge in doctrine. What worked was asking people to compromise truth. What worked was false doctrine. So whether you categorize it as one of the preceding three or not, and you see how rightly you could, I would like for us just to remember this, brethren, because it is the truth that will set you free, and only that truth as well, once you have fallen prey to the temptation and you have sinned. If there is any hope for us, it is in doctrine. It is not in our flesh. It's not in our will. It's not in our strength. It's not in our wisdom. If there's any hope for us, where is it? It's in the truth that'll set us free. So we're going to attempt to be a people who resist doctrinal error, doctrinal departure, be as faithful as we possibly can in our understanding of God's plan of salvation. And just likely, when we see anything that threatens that plan, whether it's doctrinal or moral, whether it's in some action I might perform or in some thought that I might entertain or in some doctrine that I might teach, now we stand back from it and say, you know, that's not as appealing. The price is too high. If I am armed with knowledge, if I can see the end from the beginning, if I can appreciate eternal death away from the presence of the Lord, that's the way it's described in one of the Thessalonian letters, then maybe we'll stay away from that thing. So as the next lessons develop, we're going to continue to understand some more about what Satan is doing in order that we can develop tools and enable us to resist. But tonight, as always, we appeal for a response to the gospel. This is not just, you know, an academic exercise. It is real-life war, as we talked about this morning. It is real-life reward or punishment. And so let's come to Christ. Anyone who has not, now's the time. If you need help for further Bible studies, now's the time. If you just need help with prayer or something else on your mind, let me know. Please come speak with me as we now stand and sing.